fact, it's used mostly by mental health professionals. It refers to the drive to need no one, or, more specifically, the fear of being dependent. Counterdependent people go to great lengths to avoid asking for help, to not appear or feel needy. They will make every effort not to rely on another person, even at their own great expense. Here is an example of how an emotionally neglected child grew up to be counterdependent. David. When David first came to see me for therapy, he was a successful 40-something businessman with a wife and 3 children. He had done very well financially, and his children were all young adults who would be leaving home soon. He came seeking help for long-standing depression. David initially said that his childhood was happy and free, but as he told his story, it became evident that he had been greatly affected by the absence of a key ingredient. David grew up the youngest of 7 children. He was a surprise, born 9 years after his next youngest sibling. When David was born, his mother was 47 and his father 52. David's parents were good, hard-working people who meant well, and he always knew they loved him. But by the time David was born, they were tired of raising children, and David essentially raised himself. His parents did not ask to see his report cards, all A's, and he didn't show them. If he had a problem at school, he didn't tell his parents. He knew he must handle it himself. David had complete freedom to do anything he wished after school, because his parents seldom asked him where he was. They knew he was a good kid, so they didn't worry. Even though David enjoyed this extensive freedom from rules and structure, he grew up feeling deep within himself that he was alone. The message he internalized from the freedom was, "Don't ask, don't tell." He understood from a very early age that his accomplishments were not to be shared, nor his failures, difficulties, or needs. Even though he couldn't recall his parents ever actually telling him such a thing, he absorbed it into the very fiber of his being that this was life for him. It became a part of his identity. As an adult, David presented as emotionally constricted and self-contained. Others frequently described him as aloof. His wife, after 15 years of marriage, was at the end of her rope. She felt that David was incapable of connecting with her emotionally. He told her he loved her often, but seldom showed her any emotion, positive or negative. She pointed out that he was a wonderful provider, but described their relationship as empty and meaningless. David described himself as feeling empty inside. He revealed that the one person in the world he actually felt emotional about was his teenage daughter, and that he sometimes resented her for being important to him. David was dogged by wishes to be dead, which he couldn't understand since he had such a great life. His constant fantasy was of running away to live alone on a deserted tropical island. The ingredient that was missing from David's childhood was emotional connection. Emotions were treated as non-existent in his family. There was little interaction of any kind between David and his parents, no positives, but none of the important negatives either. He didn't get to see joy in their eyes as they looked at his report card, or experience their anxiety when he came home from school long after dark. David's relationship with his parents could be summed up by one word, cordial. The message David's parents unwittingly taught him, completely outside of his own and their awareness, was, "Don't have feelings, don't show feelings, don't need anything from anyone, ever." His fantasies about being dead or running off to a tropical island were the best ways he could imagine to accomplish that mandate. David was a good boy who learned his lesson well. Signs and signals of counterdependence. You've had feelings of depression, but you don't know why. You have inexplicable, long-standing wishes to run away, or simply be dead. You remember your childhood as lonely, even if it was happy. Others describe you as aloof. Loved ones complain that you are emotionally distant. You prefer to do things yourself. It's very hard to ask for help. You're not comfortable in close relationships. If you relate to some of these signs, you may have been emotionally neglected. Keep listening. 3. Unrealistic self-appraisal. If you were asked to describe yourself, how would you answer? What adjectives would you use? What would be the balance of positive versus negative words and phrases? Most importantly, how accurate would your description be? In the book Self-Esteem by McKay and Fanning, one exercise asks the reader to take an inventory of his self-concept. The reader is asked to list his strengths and weaknesses in a number of different areas, such as physical appearance, personality, relationships, and mental functioning. McKay and Fanning point out that people with low self-esteem tend to view themselves in a negatively skewed manner. They exaggerate their weaknesses and downplay their strengths. It's true that many of the emotionally neglected have low self-esteem, but just as often, emotionally neglected adults paint inaccurate pictures of themselves, not necessarily negative, but simply off. We develop our self-concept over the course of childhood and adolescence. When we see pride on our parents' faces after a piano recital, it is validation that we played well, and it makes us want to get better. When a parent says after a Little League game, "That was some good fielding today. Let's work on your batting," it provides vital feedback to the child about his strengths and weaknesses. As children, we are like little computers, taking in feedback from the environment, storing it in memory, combining that feedback with other feedback, and developing a cohesive idea of our skills, talents, deficits, and shortcomings. We take in this data from teachers, coaches, and peers. But the most important data with the strongest impact comes from our parents. When this process goes right, it results in a balanced, realistic self-appraisal, which is the foundation of self-esteem. Such a self-appraisal is the springboard for many choices in life, such as what to strive for, what skills to develop, what colleges to apply to, what to major in, what type of mate to seek, what career to choose. It can be helpful in maintaining and preserving self-esteem. For example, a person who is not accepted into medical school can say to himself, "I'm not as good at science as I am at math. If I want to be a doctor, I'm going to have to work extra hard and keep trying." Another person without such a solid sense of himself might feel devastated and inadequate and give up. Josh came to me at the age of 46 at the urging of his girlfriend. He was a divorced father of two sons, ages 12 and 10. Josh had been in therapy for years, but felt it had not helped him. He felt stuck, both in treatment and in life. He also was privately plagued by a feeling of being a misfit. Josh described himself on numerous occasions as a square peg in a round hole. He'd had this feeling since childhood. As I got to know Josh, I came to understand the reasons why. Josh grew up in a small, affluent town in Connecticut. An only child, his father left his mother when Josh was 2 years old and was seldom seen after that. His mother never remarried. She was a dean at a local university. Josh initially described his mother as loving and doting, but when we scratched the surface on that, it became clear that her doting was actually of the material type. She spent freely on him, buying him anything he wanted. Actually, throughout Josh's childhood, she was highly focused on her career, working long hours. He described himself as a childhood loner and dreamer. After school, he wandered through the woods around their rural home with his dogs, which were truly his best friends. It was the dogs that entertained him every free hour and prevented him from feeling alone. Instead of encouraging him to have friends over, his mother was thrilled that he entertained himself and didn't require much from her, not because she didn't care about him, but because it freed her up to put everything into her work. In middle school, Josh started to have some problems being bullied at school. His bookishness earned him the moniker Dweeb, and although he tried to deal with it in many ways, his efforts only earned him the added title of Feeb. Rather than helping Josh deal with this and going through all that pain with him, his mother solved the problem by yanking him out, abruptly transferring him to a local exclusive private school. It's no surprise that Josh was even more unhappy there. He had lost a lot of confidence from the bullying. The name Dweeb Feeb still echoed in his head. Josh's mother switched him to different schools 2 more times when peer problems arose, teaching him how to escape difficult situations, but not how to face or cope with them. He therefore didn't have the opportunity to work anything through, stand up to bullies, or feel any sense of mastery or strength. When it was time to apply to colleges, Josh's mother adamantly insisted that he apply to the college where she was employed. When he resisted, she angrily washed her hands of his college search and left him to his own devices. On his own, he did get himself accepted to a good college, but graduated with a degree in English based solely on the fact that he liked to read. It's important to note here that throughout Josh's upbringing, his mother was not taking note of his strengths and weaknesses, such as his love of animals, his facility with the outdoors, or his tendency to isolate himself from other kids. She was not feeling an emotional connection to Josh. She was not paying attention and seeing him as a unique and separate person, and she was not responding competently to his emotional need. He was not seeing himself reflected in his parents' eyes, and therefore didn't develop a sense of his own abilities and challenges, or a realistic self-appraisal or identity. When it came time for Josh to go to college, he found himself without that springboard from which to make decisions such as a college and a major and a career. Despite his master's degree in English, Josh was underemployed when I met him, currently working as a truck driver delivery man for a construction supply company. He had difficulty feeling comfortable with his co-workers, as he was truly outside of his element in this job. He also found the work to be extremely tiresome and boring. Josh had tried teaching high school English for 2 years after receiving his master's in his late 30s, but he gave up teaching altogether when he found himself criticized by parents and a school administrator for not having enough control over the classroom. One of Josh's primary presenting complaints was of being incapable of choosing and committing to a career. He had great difficulty figuring out what he was interested in, what he would be good at, or where he might fit in. It was evident that he had low self-esteem and a fragile, poorly developed identity. On the surface, Josh's mother loved him, but she did not truly see her child. She made decisions about his education based not on who he was and what he needed, but on who she was and what she needed. Josh had very little opportunity to perceive his true qualities through his parents' eyes. As an adult, Josh's identity was out of balance. In the absence of attention and feedback from his parents, his identity was incompletely developed, derived only from his own observations of himself. He described himself as a loner, a dreamer, able to make good grades, directionless. His self-appraisal was painted with broad, childlike strokes. It was devoid of the complexity and nuance with which healthy adults are able to see themselves. His view of himself was heavily weighted in the negative direction. It did not provide him with a firm foundation from which to make decisions about a suitable career path. It did not help preserve his self-esteem when he received criticism in the one career he had chosen and pursued for himself, teaching. Instead, in the face of negative feedback, he folded quickly and gave up. Signs and signals of unrealistic self-appraisal. It's hard to identify your talents. You sense that you may tend to overemphasize your weaknesses. It's hard to say what you like and dislike. You're not sure what your interests are. You give up quickly when things get challenging. You chose the wrong career or changed several times. You often feel like a square peg in a round hole, a misfit. You're unsure what your parents think or thought of you. 4. No compassion for self, plenty for others. Compassion is one of the highest forms of human emotion. It is what links us together both interpersonally and as a society. Compassion often fuels our donations to charity. It motivates Good Samaritan behaviors and can help us heal from life's wounds. It is the cement of friendships and helps us forgive those who wrong us. There are two types of compassion: the compassion we feel for others and the compassion that we feel for ourselves. Emotionally neglected people have plenty of the former, but little of the latter. They are often very forgiving of others' foibles and flaws, at least on the surface. Others find them easy to talk to because they appear non-judgmental and accepting. However, they tend to be quite judgmental and perfectionist when it comes to themselves. They can get very angry with themselves for a weakness that they would easily tolerate in another. Noelle. Noelle is a 38-year-old married mother of a small child. She has an excellent education, holding advanced degrees from 2 Ivy League universities. She had a fast-track business career prior to motherhood. By all accounts, an outside observer would consider her a success. When I started treating Noelle for an anxiety disorder, she had recently been laid off and was floundering. It was clear that although she had much going on the outside, she felt something quite different on the inside. In fact, Noelle had a constant tape running inside her head saying, "What's wrong with you? You can't even park a car right. Why do you have to be overweight? For someone so intelligent, you are a lousy mother. You're such a klutz," and so forth. Any tiny error would bring on a litany of interior judgment, judgment that she'd never apply to a friend or any other human being. How did Noelle develop such a skewed compassion barometer? It is rooted in her emotional neglect. Noelle is the only child of parents who divorced when she was 6 years old. Her father was an alcoholic who was physically abusive to her mother. Noelle recalls several loud, frightening arguments prior to their separation. Noelle's mother was a social worker. She loved her daughter very much. She recognized her daughter's intelligence and often expressed pride about it to Noelle and to others. Noelle grew up knowing that she was smart, had the confidence to apply to very reputable schools, and indeed ended up with an excellent career. So what went wrong? Soon after the separation, Noelle's mother remarried a man who immediately moved in with them. Although Noelle's mother loved Noelle very much, she had a history of severe childhood trauma and abuse herself, and she regarded this as her time to heal and be herself for the first time in her life. She launched fully into her new independence and relationship and paid less and less attention to her young daughter. Meanwhile, Noelle was left to manage her own difficult emotions about her changing life circumstances, her mother's new marriage, and the loss of her father. Her mother's lack of compassion for Noelle's predicament became Noelle's lack of compassion for herself. In the absence of parental involvement and interaction, Noelle became her own parent. She microwaved frozen chicken sandwiches every morning for breakfast. She came home every afternoon to an empty house, where she sat and watched TV alone. Noelle knew that she was exceptionally bright, and she wrapped herself in her intelligence like a warm cocoon that nurtured her soul. She had, therefore, little tolerance for any errors she might make, because it disrupted her only security. Errors made her feel stupid. She scolded herself for her mistakes, thinking that it would help her to make fewer of them. She demanded of herself an A in every subject, and was very disappointed in herself for her few B's. There was no adult present in her life to put her mistakes into context, to help her understand how they happened, or to show her compassion for her disappointments. So she did not learn to do these things for herself. Instead, her harsh internal parent took the simple approach and taught her that she'd better do everything exactly right or suffer the consequences. As a result, she became paralyzed by disappointment and anger at herself. While Noelle was busy parenting herself, other children who were emotionally nurtured were learning how to forgive themselves. When they brought home a poor grade, their parents would try to discern the reasons for it, talk to them about how to correct it, and communicate to the child that everyone slips and falls sometimes. This is how healthy children learn to pick themselves up, forgive themselves, understand, and learn from their mistakes, put those mistakes behind them, and move on. Part of my work with Noelle was helping her, as an adult, to learn how to do this for herself. Signs and signals of inadequate compassion for self. Others often seek you out to talk about their problems. Others often tell you that you're a good listener. You have very little tolerance for your own mistakes. There is a critical voice inside your head pointing out your errors and flaws. You're much harder on yourself than you are on others. You often feel angry with yourself. 5. Guilt and shame. What is wrong with me? As you can tell from the last vignette, adults who were emotionally neglected can be quite perfectionistic and hard on themselves. For many, it does not stop there. When children are given the message from their parents that their feelings are a burden, excessive, or simply wrong, they will often begin to feel guilty and ashamed for having them. They will then make efforts to hide their feelings from others, or even to not have them at all. Since many emotionally neglected adults were in no way abused, they recall their childhoods as happy and carefree. They can't pinpoint any factor on which to blame their problems, so they're left blaming themselves. Often they grew up with lots of freedom, as did David and Josh. Since they were responsible for themselves as kids, they feel responsible for their imperfections as grown-ups. When a child's emotions are not acknowledged or validated by her parents, she can grow up to be unable to do so for herself. As an adult, she may have little tolerance for intense feelings or for any feelings at all. She might bury them and tend to blame herself for being angry, sad, nervous, frustrated, or even happy. The natural human experience of simply having feelings becomes a source of secret shame. What is wrong with me? Is a question she may often ask herself. Between her happy childhood and inexplicable emotions, she is left with the assumption that something is seriously amiss. Laura. When Laura was 14, she rushed home from school one day as fast as possible, desperate to talk to her mother. She had heard at school that her best friend Sally's 16-year-old brother Todd had killed himself the night before. Laura had a secret crush on Todd, who was kind to his little sister and her friend, often teasing them and driving them to soccer practice. Laura was crushed by a wave of shock, confusion, and grief, a swirl of emotions she had not felt before. When Laura got home from school, she hurried immediately to her mother, who had already heard the news. Her mother gave her a hug and said, "I'm not surprised this happened. I think he was into drugs." That was the end of the discussion. The topic was never mentioned again. Laura's mother didn't ever ask her how she felt, so Laura didn't ask herself that question. Instead, she pushed her feelings down and tried not to think about it. In the ensuing weeks, during which she attended the funeral with only her friends, since her parents didn't go, she focused on her friends, school, and soccer, but avoided Sally. Seeing Sally made Laura feel awful. Laura found herself breaking into tears for no reason, and at odd times, like during math class or in the shower. By the time she graduated from high school, two more of Laura's acquaintances, both from her school, had committed suicide. She handled these losses as she had the first, except she skipped the part about telling her mother. She dutifully attended the funerals with her friends and did not acknowledge how disturbed, confused, and shocked she felt to anyone, including herself. Laura had difficulty concentrating in school and frequently lost her temper at home. As a result, she struggled more with schoolwork. Her parents became frustrated with her and would often ask, "What's wrong with you?" But it was a rhetorical question. They did not really want to know. Laura began to see herself as weak, stupid, and uncooperative. She, too, wondered what was wrong with her. This self-view stayed with her all the way to adulthood. Generally, Laura described feeling emotionally numb. This was because she had successfully managed to cut off her feelings so that they wouldn't bother her. But each time she had strong feelings of any kind, for any reason, she felt weak and ashamed. At age 32, she told me in a therapy session, "I had a wonderful, privileged childhood, yet I wish I were dead. I have no excuse for being so depressed. Something is seriously wrong with me." For Laura, the very act of having a feeling felt shameful and wrong. By experiencing her feelings as a burden, her parents had inadvertently given her the message that she was not to have them, and that if she did, she was never to express them, even to herself. Laura's emotions were her secret shame. Signs and signals of guilt and shame. You sometimes feel depressed, sad, or angry for no apparent reason. You sometimes feel emotionally numb. You have a feeling that something is wrong with you. You feel that you are somehow different from other people. You tend to push down feelings or avoid them. You try to hide your feelings so others won't see them. You tend to feel inferior to others. You feel you have no excuse for not being happier in your life. 6. Self-directed anger, self-blame. It is difficult to feel deeply ashamed of something as innately human in oneself as emotions without getting angry with oneself for it. Shame, taken one step further, becomes self-directed anger. Let's continue with our story of Laura. Laura. As a teen and throughout adulthood, Laura was plagued by self-destructive feelings and fantasies. In college, after her boyfriend broke up with her, she took an overdose and was briefly hospitalized. Later, and throughout her adult life, she would purchase a 6-pack of beer and drink it alone in her apartment. The more she drank, the more she would start to feel. She would begin to cry, which would turn to weeping, which would turn into feeling disgusted with herself for crying. She would then become filled with intense self-hatred. She would then make some cuts on her abdomen, which she found strangely comforting, and that enabled her to fall asleep. The next day she felt better, as if she had been somehow cleansed. Laura went through her daily life numbly, with her feelings completely cut off and therefore outside of her awareness. She did not actually feel her anger, sadness, or grief. This protected her from constantly feeling weak and ashamed. But those feelings were stored inside of her like the lava under a volcano. The beer allowed her to let some of the lava shoot out, which felt both intensely shameful and cleansing. For Laura, the overdose and the cutting were expressions of self-directed anger. Deep down, Laura hated herself, not for any real failings or shortcomings or flaws, but for being sad and hurt, and for being unable to explain to herself why she was sad and hurt. In her mind, she was damaged goods, and she had no excuse for it. Signs and signals of self-directed anger and blame. You get angry at yourself easily and often. You use alcohol or drugs as a release. You often feel disgusted with yourself. You have self-destructive episodes or tendencies. You blame yourself for not being happier and more normal. 7. The fatal flaw. If people really know me, they won't like me. One characteristic that most emotionally neglected adults share is a secret and carefully guarded feeling of being different or flawed. As you saw earlier, Laura felt ashamed of having feelings, which made her feel weak and damaged. When a person feels deep within himself that something is wrong with him, his natural tendency is to try to make sense of that feeling, or explain it to himself. Each emotionally neglected person comes up with his own unique explanation for what is wrong with me, based upon his own particular childhood and family circumstances. I once put 8 emotionally neglected women into a therapy group together, hoping that they would help each other to see the elusive acts of omission by those who had raised them that had led to so many of their difficulties. Over the course of a year, they had put a name to the common characteristic that they felt bound them together as a group. They called it the fatal flaw. The fatal flaw is not a real flaw, but it is a real feeling. It is the emotionally neglected adult's deep-seated, buried belief about herself, the thing that makes her feel different from everyone else, estranged from the world, or unacceptable to others. It's held close to the chest, hidden away at all costs. The fatal flaw is a capsule which contains within it echoes of the child's attempt to understand, what is wrong with me? Emotionally neglected people tend to feel that they must keep their true selves hidden away from others, because if they let people get too close to them, their flaw will be exposed. For one person, the flaw might be a belief that he is worthless. For Laura, it was the secret shame that she was weak. For Noelle, it was a belief that she was stupid. But each emotionally neglected person has his or her own. Here's the story of Carrie. Carrie. Carrie grew up the youngest of 3 children. Her father was a diesel mechanic and her mother a stay-at-home mom. She had a brother who was 6 years older and a sister 4 years older. She described her high school-educated parents as homebodies, meaning that they were in no way adventurous, curious, or interested in the world. They were good, simple people who wanted only to work hard and raise their children. They did not think about the world in any complex way, and they certainly didn't pay the least bit of mind to what they themselves or any of their children might feel. Carrie's mother had the exact same rules for Carrie and her sister, even though they were 4 years apart in age. She dressed them alike, cut their hair alike, they had the same bedtime, the same amount of freedom, and were required to do most everything together. Carrie's older sister felt the terrible injustice of this and resented Carrie for intruding on every aspect of her life. Neither Carrie nor her sister was treated as, or felt like, a self-contained, individual human being. They were treated as if they were 2 parts of the same person. Carrie grew up baffled, wondering why her older sister hated her so, and trying her hardest to get into her sister's good graces. No matter what she did, her sister despised her. Her simple child analysis of the situation was, "I'm not likable." When Carrie, who as an adult discovered that she has attention deficit disorder and learning disabilities, began to struggle academically in middle school, her parents did not notice. When she brought home a report card full of C's and D's, her mother's reaction was, "Well, it's okay. All you can do is try your hardest." Carrie gleaned from this comment that not much was expected of her, because she didn't have much to work with in terms of intelligence. In the absence of any more complex explanations or higher expectations, she had developed two important assumptions about herself. She was unlikable, and she was dumb. When Carrie had typical middle school friendship problems, she applied the same type of simple cause-effect analysis. Her explanation for every such incident was, "When people get to know me, they don't like me." This became her explanation for every breakup with every boy she dated, and for every social glitch that she encountered in her life. By the time I met Carrie, she was in her mid-30s. She had developed an avoidance style, in which she very rarely initiated any social interaction, anticipating rejection around every corner. Carrie made me work hard in therapy. She offered very little of herself spontaneously. She was highly skilled at chit-chat, but it was like pulling teeth to get her to talk with any depth about herself and her life. By avoiding substance, she was making herself uninteresting to others. Carrie felt friendless and alone, and it was because she wasn't offering enough meaningful connection to keep friendships or relationships going. She claimed to want marriage and children, but gave up on every romantic relationship as soon as the man had any kind of issue with her, assuming that he, like all the others, didn't like her now that he knew her. Deep inside, she harbored a secret knowledge that she shared with no one and tried her best to hide, but which ruled her life. "If people get to know me, they won't like me." It was her fatal flaw. Signs and signals of the fatal flaw. You fear getting close to people. It's hard to open up to even your best friends. You tend to expect rejection around every corner. You avoid initiating friendships. It can be hard for you to keep conversations going. You feel that if people get too close to you, they won't like what they see. 8. Difficulty nurturing self and others. Nurturance can best be described as a combination of love, care, and help. Children who are not emotionally nurtured can grow up to have a great deal of difficulty providing emotional nurturance to others. Remember David, the youngest of 7 children, ignored as a child and unable to connect as an adult? Let's talk a little more about him. David. As mentioned before, David's parents were hard-working, decent people who meant well. They provided a lovely home for him, nice clothes, and plenty of food. All of his material needs were met. His mother was a housewife, almost always physically present. David grew up knowing that he was loved by his parents, but he did not grow up feeling that he was loved by his parents. Not because they purposely didn't love him, but because feelings of all kinds, positive or negative, were not exhibited or allowed in their household. David was well nurtured physically, but he did not receive emotional nurturance. As an adult in a therapy group, David almost cringed when anyone in the group showed intense feelings. He was a master at offering practical, rational advice to any member who was in pain, but he did so with an absence of emotion. His advice was well-intentioned, but was delivered without feeling. His style did not go unnoticed by other group members, who would often get defensive and have trouble accepting his advice. Most of us know that personal advice of any kind is best received when it is accompanied by a feeling of caring. Members of the group appreciated David's practical advice, but not his cold presentation. David was not able to emotionally connect to the people in the group for fear that they might emotionally connect to him. They might grow to need him. They might actually depend on him. David often expressed a grave discomfort with being needed or cared for. Remember how David felt about his daughter? He resented her for making him care about her. Like compassion, nurturance is an emotional glue that binds us together as people. It is the gas that fills our emotional tanks. It is a requirement for healthy parenting, and in a good marriage, it should be abundant and mutual between husband and wife. When we receive nurturance from our parents as children, we internalize it, and it becomes a part of us. As adults, we are then able to provide nurturance to others when they need it, be it our parents, our friends, our spouse, or our children. Children are like sponges, absorbing their parents' love, care, and help. A sponge too long away from water will go dry and eventually harden. So too, a child too long away from love, care, and help will harden and wall off, and will have trouble receiving and giving nurturance. This is what happened to David. He could neither feel nor express love. Signs and signals of difficulty nurturing self and others. People sometimes tell you that you come across as distant or maybe even cold. People sometimes think you're arrogant. You often think others are too emotional. Others come to you for practical advice, but not for emotional support. You feel uncomfortable when someone cries in your presence. You are uncomfortable crying yourself, especially in the presence of another person. You don't like the feeling that someone really needs you. You don't like feeling needy. 9. Poor self-discipline. All of us need to use self-discipline every day and in many ways. We get up on time, shower, eat well, exercise, concentrate, do chores, save money. We learned how to make ourselves do these necessary tasks through the structure, love, and expectations of those who raised us. It is remarkable the number of emotionally neglected people who have tremendous difficulty with these things that we call self-discipline. I have found that the emotionally neglected often struggle to stop themselves from doing things they shouldn't, like eating junk food, overspending, and other self-indulgences. Conversely, they also have difficulty forcing themselves to do things they don't want to do, like chores, tasks, work, or exercise. Often they will say, "I'm so frustrated with myself, I just can't seem to get started." Yes, all of us struggle with this to some extent, but the emotionally neglected person's struggle is more chronic and intense. It becomes a lifelong theme. Emotionally neglected people will come to treatment calling themselves scattered, lazy, unmotivated, or procrastinators. When they talk about their childhood, you discover that their parents, however giving and loving, did not provide real structure for learning the skill of self-discipline. For example, they did not make the child do such things as his homework before he could go outside, chores and tasks around the house, or exercise to earn TV time. Each time that a parent sets and enforces such rules and expectations, those rules and expectations become a part of the child's repertoire. The child learns a lesson in how to force himself to do something tedious. On the other hand, emotionally neglectful parents often do not stop the child from eating too much junk food or from blowing all their money. When a child is left to his own devices, he will learn how to indulge himself. Emotional neglect often sets us up for problems with self-indulgence. Many emotionally neglected children have parents who love them very much and provide them with every physical need. But part of parenting is seeing your child for who he is, not only noticing the things that he's good at, but also noticing the things that are hardest for him, and putting in the effort to make sure that he addresses those. Many emotionally neglectful parents are very caring, but simply are not involved with their child at that level. William came to therapy in his late 30s. He was dogged by a feeling that he should be achieving more. He had an MBA from a very reputable business school, and psychological testing that was done in his 20s had revealed that he had a very high IQ. Yet William had had a series of unchallenging jobs that did not use his degree or pay at the level that he should have been able to command. He recently had been laid off and was concerned that his boss had not been totally happy with his performance. William reported that he struggled greatly with self-discipline in both his professional and private life. At times, he stayed up all night working and then overslept the next morning. His wife complained that he would sometimes forget to eat and rarely exercise. Despite his best intentions and efforts, he was very slow to start difficult, boring, or unpleasant tasks. Once he did start such a task, he would immediately think of something better to do and switch over to that. He had received feedback from employers that he was too slow in completing his work. He reported feeling very frustrated with himself for low productivity, stating, "I'm a terrible procrastinator. I'm lazy. And what is wrong with me?" William's parents divorced soon after he was born, and his father was not a part of his life. As a single parent, his mother lavished love on him. He was the apple of her eye. And indeed, William was a great kid. He was smart, popular, and didn't get into trouble. His teachers liked him, and his grades were good. His mother told him often that he was wonderful, and generally left him to do things on his own. She had to work a full-time job to support them, and she trusted that he would be fine without a lot of supervision from her. So William grew up with lots of freedom, lots of love, not much supervision, and very little structure. He remembers doing term papers at the last minute, taking tests without studying, and running with friends all day and late into the night through middle and high school. He didn't have many chores or home responsibilities, and the ones he did have were very flexible. His mother was quick to relax the rules or let him off the hook. Likewise, if he had an academic slip, his teachers would usually give him the benefit of the doubt because he was a bright, respectful kid with good intentions. Working outside his comfort zone and sticking with tedious chores were challenges that he seldom faced. You're probably thinking that this sounds like a fun childhood, and yes, it was in many ways. But the problem was that it did not prepare William for the demands of adulthood. In his most recent job, he was required to work with clients to complete projects for them. He had to find out what the client wanted, lay out the plans for creating it, and deliver it by a deadline. In many of these projects, he had to coordinate contributions from members of his team to make sure it all worked together. William loved this job and the creativity that it required of him. However, the coordination and scheduling aspects bored him to tears. When he had to do the final write-up, he would procrastinate. He missed deadlines, and his boss quickly became frustrated. This was a familiar pattern for William, and he grew insecure. William was smart enough, personable enough, and he needed and enjoyed the job. So what was missing? The lack of struggle in William's childhood had prepared him very well for life, as long as no unpleasant demands arose. As an adult, William is skilled at running free, metaphorically speaking, but when a boss demands results, or he himself needs to strive for a goal, he does not have the self-discipline to make it happen. As his mother took the path of least resistance by giving in easily and not pushing or structuring, so did William. William would have benefited greatly from regular kitchen duty at home, for example. If his mother had noticed his lack of challenge in high school, perhaps an advanced math or language class would have been found for him. More rules and structure at home would have helped William internalize rules and structure for himself. And conflicts with his mother about whether he wiped the counters properly might have taught him the importance of being thorough, even when doing a mundane, thankless task. William missed out on learning how to structure himself, or how to make himself do things he didn't want to do. Because he was a smart and personable kid, his lack of self-regulation went undetected until he entered the adult world of work, at which point it became clear that he ran short on an ability to tolerate boredom, an ability to structure himself, and an ability to persevere, all of which are necessary parts of every successful adult. Signs and signals of poor self-discipline. You feel that you are lazy. You're a procrastinator. You have great difficulty with deadlines. You tend to overeat, drink too much, oversleep, or overspend. You are bored with the tedium of life. You tend to avoid mundane tasks. You get angry at yourself for how little you get done. You're an underachiever. You have poor self-discipline. You're often disorganized, even though you know you have the capacity to do better. 10. Alexithymia. If there is one symptom that could be considered the common denominator of emotional neglect, it is probably alexithymia. It is present to one degree or another in every single emotionally neglected adult. The word alexithymia cannot be found in most dictionaries. It's not a word used by the general public. It's a word used primarily by psychologists and other mental health professionals, and mostly in research settings. Alexithymia denotes a person's deficiency in, knowledge about, and awareness of emotion. In its extreme form, the alexithymic is a person for whom feelings are indecipherable, both their own and other people's. The alexithymic lives his life with no willingness or ability to tolerate or even experience emotions. I have observed that many people with alexithymia have a tendency to be irritable. They tend to snap at others for seemingly no reason, and it obviously interferes with their relationships. It allows them to hold others at a distance, even as it leaves them feeling terribly alone. Emotions that are not acknowledged or expressed tend to jumble together and emerge as anger. Eventually, suppressed feelings refuse to stay down. When they do, they erupt as small spurts of irritability that hurt others. Here is an example of an emotionally neglected man who was severely alexithymic. Cal. Cal, a tall, thin man who looked almost emaciated, came for therapy in his mid-50s. He was referred by his primary care physician in 1999, after he told her that he planned to kill himself at the end of the millennium. In his first session, he was very clear about this plan. His angry and dismissive demeanor in our first session was striking. These hostile emotions were the only ones he was willing or able to display. As I got to know Cal, it soon became clear that he was both an alcoholic and an underachiever. Although he had a degree in engineering, he worked as an appliance repairman by day and drank beer alone in his apartment by night. He had never married, had no children, and lived alone. For many years, Cal had fantasized about disappearing. After months of therapy, he was able to share this secret fantasy. He would run away to a bucolic forest and live as a hermit, without telling family, friends, or anyone who knew him. He derived intense pleasure from imagining the reactions of sadness and shock of all who knew him when they heard he had disappeared, how worried and upset they might be, how they would wish for him to come back. Cal had two older brothers, and his parents were still living. In therapy, he expressed intense resentment, bordering on hatred, toward his entire family. He was unable to explain why he felt this way. But he reported that about 1 year prior to coming to treatment, he had dug out and destroyed every family picture he owned, including the ones of himself as a child. He was unable to give any explanation for this action, and did not respond to my curiosity about it with any curiosity of his own. Cal had also been put on probation several times at his work for snapping irritably at co-workers and customers. As Cal talked in therapy, this all began to make sense. He grew up in a blue-collar town in upstate New York. His parents were second-generation German immigrants. His father worked in a factory, and his mother stayed home to raise Cal and his two older brothers. There was no abuse in his family. Cal was well-protected, well-fed, and well-clothed. When asked about his relationships with his brothers, he stated simply that he'd enjoyed playing baseball with his brothers until they hit middle school age, at which point they stopped playing with him. In fact, this was the only example he could give of any interaction of importance that had ever occurred in his family at all. When asked, Cal reported that, in his memory, no one in his family had ever yelled, cried, hugged, kissed, touched, winked, or expressed emotion of any kind. In fact, Cal was quite perplexed by my questions about emotions. It was clear that he didn't speak the language of emotion. The concept of feeling was simply not on his radar screen. However, anger was the one emotion that was familiar to Cal. He felt it very often, essentially all day, every day. He tried to control it at work, so he wouldn't get in trouble with his boss, and he drank it away at night so that he could fall asleep. Despite its omnipresence in his life, he was not aware that he had it. He didn't notice it. He didn't question it. He was, however, comfortable with it because it was a part of him, like an arm or a heartbeat. The nature of his emotional neglect had left him severely emotionally stunted. In all of his relationships, unable to understand what he felt or to read what others felt, unable to know what he could ask of someone or what he had to offer them, he was emotionally crippled and alone. No wonder he drank. No wonder he fantasized about leaving others behind to miss him and regret that they hadn't been there for him. And small wonder that thoughts of suicide soothed him when indecipherable emotions leaked from the lockbox that was his life history. After all, it is only emotion and connection which bring meaning to this strange thing we call existence. The first stage of therapy for Cal was to become aware of his anger. The second, more difficult stage, was to help Cal stop drinking as a way of stuffing his emotions, and to teach him to sit with his emotions. The third and most difficult stage was to help